4 months after the Trump-backed ceasefire for Gaza was put in place, Indonesia says it's preparing to send thousands of troops to the Palestinian territory as peacekeepers.
That might include having to get into confrontation with Hamas and other Palestinians writ large.
How an international stabilization force for Gaza might work. I'm Marco Werman. Also across Europe's mountains, there's been a record number of avalanche deaths this winter.
Most of the accidents happen actually with experienced mountaineers.
And why the problem of light pollution often goes unnoticed.
People tend to be a bit ignorant to the presence of the night, unfortunately.
Plus, tough news for all you beer drinkers out there.
Brace yourselves. We are in trouble as an industry.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment in Bangladesh, where she's covering the upcoming election there. We begin today in Washington, where President Donald Trump hosted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This was the seventh meeting between the two leaders since the start of Trump's second term. In a social media post that followed, Trump said he talked with Netanyahu about ongoing U.S. negotiations with Iran. The president said he wants to reach a deal with the Iranian government. He also included an implicit threat, saying, quote, "Last time Iran decided that they were better off not making a deal, that did not work well for them." The social media post from Trump also mentioned Gaza, and despite the fact that the Israeli military has killed hundreds of Palestinians in recent months, the president wrote, "There is truly peace in the Middle East." On Tuesday, Indonesia announced that it's preparing to send 5,000 to 8,000 troops to be part of an international stabilization force in the Gaza Strip. That force is part of the Trump peace plan that was agreed to back in October. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, there is still a lot of uncertainty about the deployment of any peacekeeping forces.
The spokesperson for Indonesia's president made the announcement to reporters.
"We have started training personnel who might later serve as peacekeepers, so that means engineering, medical units, the types often deployed. We are preparing such units."
In his statement, translated by France 24, he said that the force would be around 8,000 or more. He said that the details are still being negotiated. This is the first major movement on the topic of these forces in Gaza. President Trump announced his plan for post-conflict Gaza last year. Part of the plan includes the Stabilization Force and the Board of Peace. Last November, the UN Security Council endorsed the creation of both of these. But despite the plan, ceasefire remains elusive in Gaza, says Jason Campbell. He's a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington.
"You're not seeing the day-to-day battles that were taking place for so long throughout Gaza, but you are seeing nearly on a daily basis the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, carrying out strikes. You see Hamas operatives pressing the boundaries of this yellow line. So it's not the environment yet where you would say is ripe for peacekeeping forces."
Late last year, the Israeli military divided Gaza into color-coded zones. The yellow line separates Hamas-controlled areas in Gaza from the areas that Israel controls. Given the remaining hostilities, countries have been reluctant to send forces to Gaza, Campbell says.
"Force-contributing nations who are interested in a peacekeeping scenario have little appetite for engaging in what would be more of a peace enforcement that might include having to get into confrontation with Hamas and other Palestinians writ large."
Italy, Turkey, and Egypt are some of the other nations considering being part of the ISF. Participation of international forces will be critical for President Trump's plan to move ahead. As part of the plan, Hamas has to disarm, and once that happens, Israeli troops will withdraw. But this week, senior Hamas officials said the group has no plan to lay down its arms. What worries some of the nations is that if they do send in troops, they might get caught up in possible attacks. "It doesn't help that the mission of the force is not clarified," says Campbell of the Middle East Institute.
"Even if they're not targeted, if it was some sort of a rocket or other similar attack that killed or wounded Indonesian forces, that comes with a lot of political pressure on senior Indonesian authorities back home. It also brings pressure on who's going to respond and when and how."
Back in December, the U.S. announced that the ISF forces will be overseen by an American general, Jasper Jeffers. The Trump administration has insisted that U.S. forces will not be on the ground in Gaza. But Campbell says the appointment of the two-star general could send a message that the U.S. is going to play a leading role. Arthur Boutelis is with the International Peace Institute. He says that Indonesia sending in troops could be a positive step.
It's not an end state, but it could become an important transitional mechanism, right? A bridge from helping the ceasefire really stick and become a reality, move into sort of a stabilization phase and hopefully a reconstruction phase beyond just facilitating humanitarian operations. That will be important.
The UN Security Council set a two-year mandate for the ISF. Boutelis says the forces could eventually play a long-term role in a peace process and a political settlement. His organization set up a session last month involving some of the potential contributing states, as well as Israeli and Palestinian representatives.
The fact that, you know, representatives of a variety of member states, including permanent members of the Security Council, as well as many potential troop contributing countries alongside, you know, Israeli and Palestinian voices, I think was very useful.
Indonesia has long advocated for Palestinian statehood. Its president has said that the country would normalize relations with Israel if it agrees to a two-state solution. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
U.S. troops are preparing to deploy to Nigeria. Nigerian Military Command says the deployment comes at Nigeria's request. Officials emphasize that these soldiers, 200 of them, will not serve in combat roles. Instead, they will focus on training Nigerian forces battling Islamist militants. Some U.S. troops are already on the ground in Nigeria. They arrived after President Trump ordered airstrikes on Islamic State targets in northern Nigeria on Christmas Day. To learn more, we spoke with Amaka Anku. She's a political risk analyst who heads up the Africa practice at Eurasia Group. She joined us from Cape Town, South Africa. First of all, Amaka, I want to ask about this statement put out by generals in Nigeria that they requested assistance from the U.S. Should we take that at face value?
Honestly, hard to tell. But what I will say is that the training cooperation with the United States military is not new. It's getting a lot more attention now because of some of the comments that Trump has made, but it's quite typical.
Was a statement somewhat surprising to you, given how some officials in Nigeria have said Washington doesn't quite understand what our country is facing?
Not surprising. I mean, it's clear that the Nigerian authorities have been trying to appease the U.S., right? Nigeria has elections coming up next year. The last thing they need is constant negative headlines on something that is very divisive inside Nigeria, right? And so the authorities want to, as much as possible, cooperate with the U.S. to reduce tensions and make sure that this isn't an issue that becomes an explosive, divisive issue.
Is President Bola Tinubu seeing this arrival of U.S. troops as good for him politically?
So look, you know, a lot of Northerners are very big on sovereignty. They wouldn't like the idea of anything that sounds like, you know, Nigeria is giving up its sovereignty or like giving a base to the U.S. or anything like that, although there's been some discussions about giving some space for refueling. So I wouldn't say it's good for him, but it is good for him to look like he is managing it, look like he has exercising some level of control in terms of guiding how the U.S. intervenes. And I think that's exactly what he's trying to do and so far achieving.
Amaka, do we know what these U.S. troops will actually be doing in Nigeria?
They've said they're not combat troops. It'll be training and other kinds of assistance. And I take them at face value when they say that, right? Because I don't see, I mean, what are you going to do with 200 troops?
Can you just give us a little background to the military relationship between Nigeria and the U.S. over the years and what there is to build on with this arrival?
Generally speaking, before Obama's administration, the United States has been a pretty significant security partner for Nigeria. There was a time when there were some human rights activists that complained that the Nigerian military has been not adhering to certain principles or rules, and there were civilians that were getting killed. And so they restricted sales of certain kinds of military equipment from the U.S. to Nigeria. And that did impact the relationship, right? And there were fewer of these kinds of corporations and trainings because they were buying less things from the U.S. So historically, the U.S. has always been one of Nigeria's main security partners, not the only one. And I think what we're seeing now is we're going back to that. They're removing some of those restrictions that had been in place in terms of sales of military equipment. And from what I've heard, there's a lot more weapons sales planned in the next 18 months from the U.S. to Nigeria.
That's really interesting. And in terms of why, we can wonder, but in late October, the White House began warning that Christianity faces what it called an existential threat in Nigeria. Is that how you understand the basic mission for these U.S. soldiers?
No. So the rhetoric from the U.S. officials is definitely more a signaling to domestic constituents that are Christians. But the reason it's possible is because there are domestic opposition groups inside Nigeria that have used that rhetoric and pushed that rhetoric in the U.S. because they feel left out of the political landscape in Nigeria because it's currently being run by a Muslim president and a Muslim vice president. But of course, the Muslim president is married to a Christian, and there's absolutely no persecution of Christian happening. There's no evidence of that. What is happening is that there are armed groups, both jihadist terrorist groups and just pure criminal armed groups, who are attacking communities and getting into other kinds of clashes over land and cattle and resources. The troops are not going to be there to protect Christians. And I would even argue that, if anything, the rhetoric from the United States about persecution of Christians has actually done more to endanger Christians in Nigeria. Because what happens if one of the most important people in the world is saying, oh, look at Nigeria, Christian persecution? If you are a criminal group in Nigeria and you want attention, what are you going to go do? Attack some Christians so that you get in the headline, right?
So if that's how you see the reality on the ground, how do you think a U.S. military presence is going to deal with those dynamics if it's not about Christianity, if it's about robbers and thieves?
200 troops isn't going to solve Nigeria's security problems. Yes, if there's some training, if there's some new capabilities, if there's some new thinking that they can share or impart to the Nigerian counterparts, yeah, it could help on the margins. The biggest problem Nigeria is dealing with is that it is incredibly under-policed. The presidency itself said that they had 30,000 police officers. This is a country with 230 million people. There are lots of parts of the country that just have no policing. And the way you're going to solve the problem ultimately is to have a lot more policing that are resourced to collect intelligence and then prevent attacks before they happen, right?
What do you think is the best case scenario in terms of outcomes for both governments?
You have already, in part because of the rhetoric from Trump that brought more attention to the issue and brought more attacks on Christians, by the way, the president has been seen to be acting on the issue. He fired his defense minister, shook up some of the security forces. They're buying more weapons. So the best case scenario is that these things that he has done are seen to help the security situation, that there's stronger morale and they are pushing a little bit harder on the terrorists. They're pushing them back. Communities feel safer. And it's a win-win, right? Trump and U.S. officials can say, look, we helped, but to the extent of how much they helped can be questionable. Doesn't really matter. They can say we helped. And Nigerians can say, look, you're safer. But it's still, we did it. The U.S. didn't do it, right? So I think that's the best case scenario.
Amaka Anku is with the Eurasia Group, where she directs their Africa practice. She spoke with us from Cape Town. Just ahead, is the beer world drying up? Some industry news suggests it might be. Hear about the trends that keep beer company executives up at night. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The explosion of craft beer brands seems to suggest that we're living in a golden age of beer. But demand is actually down. Heineken, one of the earliest and most successful international brands of beer, just announced big layoffs. The company says that 6,000 jobs will be eliminated over the next few years. In August of 2025, the company's U.S. CEO, Maggie Timoney, told CNBC that Heineken was adjusting to new challenges in the global marketplace.
We focus on what we can control and on our strategy, which is fueling our investment behind our core brands, Heineken and Dos Equis, in key priority markets, and also fueling that investment behind those brands and markets and innovating in order to be there when our consumers want us to be there and also for our future consumers. And to that point, actually, Brandon, you might be interested that we tested this year Heineken 00 Ultimate, or as we affectionately know it, 00. Mm-hmm. Zero alcohol, zero calories, zero sugar. So we are expanding that test next year.
To talk about the big changes in the beer business, we reached out to Rick Kempen. He's with Beer & Co., a specialty beer distribution company based in the Netherlands. I started by asking him about his reaction to the Heineken news. And by the way, Beer & Co. is connected with Bavaria Pils, another Dutch beer brand that competes with Heineken.
My reaction is this will probably be the first of a number of layoffs with the larger brewery groups in the world. You could have seen this coming for quite a while.
Really? Even last summer, the U.S. CEO kind of suggested that the ground is shifting.
The ground is shifting, and it was really surprising to hear her speak so hopefully about the future consumer, because, you know, we've seen a trend in the last decade that consumers are drinking less alcohol in general, and since beer is the largest alcoholic beverage in the world, they do drink a lot of less beer than they used to do. And combine that with another trend we see where younger generations drinkers are drinking less to begin with, they're actually more and more abstaining from alcohol in total. It's a scary thought that you, as one of the largest brewery groups in the world last year, still was so hopeful about future consumers.
Yeah, well, you said this has been seen from a long distance off, this news. What kind of signal, though, do these layoffs at Heineken send to the beer industry more generally?
Brace yourselves. We are in trouble as an industry. Alcohol in general is under pressure, both from NGOs, governments. They're trying to send it the same route as they've done with tobacco, trying to actually kick it out of our lives. But that is not just the pressure from society. You do see that consumers in general are more thoughtful about what they consume. And alcohol, since in the end of the day, it's a great drink, but it is in potential detrimental to your health that people abstain from it more and more, and particularly the younger generation.
Yeah, so you see the primary damage to beer, to the beer industry, coming from these health concerns?
Absolutely. That's a very simple answer. Absolutely. Let me put it in a different perspective. I'm 57. For me, it was quite normal to start drinking alcohol at social events, at parties, every Friday night when I was 16 to 18. My daughter is in that same age range, and she looks at me quite bewildered, saying, "Dad, did you really drink that natural alcohol always?" She only does it very rarely at certain parties, and is definitely consuming less alcohol than I did at that age. And we see this throughout the Western world.
Can't these social moments happen around non-alcoholic drinks?
True. But then you do not get the lubrication thing that alcohol is always facilitating. And that can be both a risk and an opportunity.
Sure.
You know, it loosens you up a little bit, doesn't it?
How do you think, just at a practical level, breweries are going to adapt?
Well, you were saying about non-alcoholic drinks. That has been the answer for the past, let's say, 15 years, focusing on non-alcoholic beer. But we do now see that even social resistance is developing towards alcohol-free beers. What you do now see is that many breweries are focusing more on what we call beyond beer products. You can anticipate things like kombuchas or any other vegetable, herb, or spice, as long as they tick a couple of boxes. Non-alcoholic, low on sugar, low on carbs, and potentially also with health benefits. Beyond beer is the category that I believe breweries should all be focusing on, both big and small, to face these headwinds.
Rick, Bavaria Pils, one of the brands that your company does business with, is it also facing a downturn in demand?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I can be very short about that. You know, there is hardly any industrial beer brand that is not suffering. And I'm not sure if we're now talking about the layoffs at Heineken. Please do realize that, for example, in Germany, one of the leading beer cultures in Europe, over the past 10 years, they've lost about 40% of beer consumption. And that is in a country where beer is still part of daily life and part of daily culture. Out of the 1,400 family breweries that were active in Germany, there's only 900 left.
Wow.
500 of them, so one third, have closed over the past decade or 15 years. It is a scary development.
That's incredible. Back in the day in the U.S., Heineken was the imported beer. I mean, still today, it's the number two brewery in the world. Is that a source of pride for the Dutch on some level?
First of all, you know, the Dutch are not really that great in terms of patriotism or being proud of what they do. No, seriously, we're not. We are a bunch of Calvinists, and we basically say, act normal, that's weird enough.
You show up in force in those orange jerseys, though, at the World Cup.
Yeah, well, that's for compensation reasons. Great. The thing is, though, you know, Heineken is considered premium just about everywhere else in the world, but not necessarily in the Netherlands. Still, I do believe that most Dutch consumers, when they will feel proud about the fact that it doesn't really matter where you are in the world and the darkest jungle you may venture into, there is always going to be, in the end of the day, two drinks, two brands that you will always see, Coca-Cola and Heineken.
And to that point, that was an impressive trick. I mean, Heineken was the luxury beer brand at one point all over the globe. How did the company do that and basically change the game?
That was really the work of Freddie Heineken himself in those days. He basically went on hand sales, going to bars in the States and asking, do you sell Heineken? And they said, no, we don't. We never even heard of it. A week later, the sales rep would come in and would say, hey, we've got this beautiful import brand called Heineken from the Netherlands. Oh, yeah, there was this guy last week asking about this. Sure, we'll give it a try. That was really how it worked back, yeah. I think, 40, 50 years or so. And besides that, they have maintained a very consistent global marketing effort where they've always been premiumizing the beer and always have been focusing on the fun part and the social part of drinking their particular brand. And I think that was the key factor to the success of Global Heineken.
Rick, finally, I'm intrigued by your job title, Beer Ambassador. How do you become a beer ambassador?
Hard work. Hard work. Be consistent about promoting beer in general. In the end of the day, you know, I've been working in the beer industry for 30 years and spent all my life promoting and advocating beer and the sensible enjoyment of it. Let's always underline that. I am still intrigued by the fact that tens of thousands of brewers worldwide with only using four base ingredients can create something different, something fascinating, something new every day and again. And that fascination has led me to investigate all there is to know about beer. And in the end of the day, now I know all of that, I can truly be a beer ambassador and spread the beer gospel.
Is a vacancy on the horizon? I'm just asking for a friend.
I'm retiring in 12 years. Let's try again then.
Talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Rick Kempen is a beer ambassador with Beer & Co. of the Netherlands. Dank u wel. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Over the course of this ski season in Europe, a record 63 people have lost their lives in avalanches. One reason for this is heavier than average snowfall at high elevations. Another factor, more people are skiing outside of designated ski runs, off-piste as it's known. Meanwhile, lower altitudes have barely seen any snow at all, forcing hundreds of ski resorts to close, some of them permanently. The World's Jerry Haddon has more from Barcelona.
Tim Phillips, a Brit living in Barcelona, is gearing up for a weekend of Skimo in the Spanish Pyrenees.
These are the skins. They're called skins because they used to be made out of seal skin. And the idea of them is they're a bit like Velcro, where
Skimo is short for ski mountaineering, where you put sticky skins on your skis, hike up, then ski down.
The lovely thing about that kind of backcountry skiing is that you can go anywhere and you can go into the middle of nowhere with no other skiers there at all. And you're going up under your own steam.
Before leaving his apartment, Phillips double checks his avalanche safety gear, including his electronic beacon, snow shovel for digging someone out, and a long pole that clips together.
And what is that for?
So this is avalanche skier. So this is to probe around once you've located a person using what I'm going to show you now. It's called an ARPA.
Phillips is taking no chances, especially this year, because the danger of avalanches is higher than usual. In December, three experienced ski mountaineers were killed in Spain, and that was just the beginning.
I think these days I'm really prudent. I mean, I'm not doing stupid stuff anymore, and I'm not kind of wandering around in the middle of nowhere. So I think I'll just, if someone says to me, yeah, it's too much snow, it's a bit dangerous, I just won't go out.
This TV footage illustrates how dangerous going off-piste can be. It shows rescue helicopters searching in the dark for any survivors in the Italian Alps. 13 people have perished in just the last week in Italy, some not far from where the Winter Olympics are underway. The reason for this year's higher-than-usual avalanche danger, it has to do with how, when, and where the snow has fallen. High in the French Alps, for example, it snowed lightly in November, then weeks of cold, snowless weather set in, turning that snow into a layer of ice.
And then what happened in January, unfortunately, is that there was a big snowfall that landed on a solid, icy, old layer.
This is Julie Schneeman, an editor with Snowbrains, an online source for information on conditions for skiing and other outdoor sports. She calls the snowfall unfortunate because the new loose powder didn't bond to the ice below.
The avalanche warnings were in some regions at 5, which people unfortunately chose to ignore. So there were unfortunately a lot of deaths.
Avalanche danger is measured on a scale from 1 to 5. Piles of loose snow on top of a weak layer of ice is the nightmare scenario.
You can trigger the weak layer and the weak layer propagates the cracking. And then the whole slope comes down and can hit you in flat terrain even.
Thomas Feistel is with the Bavarian Avalanche Warning System in southern Germany. He says if people stick to official ski slopes, they're safe. But off-piste sports, not only ski-mo, but snowshoeing and plain old hiking, have become more popular in recent years.
So people just go out hiking because there's not much snow and you can still go hiking without skis. It's possible. But they are often not equipped for avalanche accidents or anything.
Feistel says, ironically, it isn't the beginners who are dying. For the most part, he says, they heed the official advice and avoid danger.
Most of the accidents happen actually with experienced mountaineers. It's the question how long you expose yourself to the risk and to what risk. And I would say that the mountaineers are the highly experienced ones. They are still exposing themselves.
But for all the snow at higher elevations, lower down, where snowfall used to be just as plentiful, many slopes are dry and brown.
Oui, c'est exactement ça. On avait à peu près une trentaine de centimètres de neige.
At the Des Etapes ski resort in France, owner Yves Gaëtan has had a disastrous season so far. It did snow early in the season, he said, about 20 inches, but warm temperatures melted what there was in just 2 days. Des Etables is one of around 180 resorts in France alone that remain closed this year due to a lack of snow. Meanwhile, back in the Spanish Pyrenees, the resorts are white. High up at Boy de Tau ski station, the Skimo World Cup was recently held, all on piste, of course, due to the dangers of snowslides. Also on piste that day was amateur Tim Phillips.
Hey, Jerry. So I'm walking along, and it's a beautiful morning. There's been lots of snow again last night, and it's a 4 out of 5 avalanche warning. And actually, there's just been terrible avalanches everywhere, all over the Pyrenees and the Alps. So I'm going to do quite a lot of stuff by the pistes.
Phillips being prudent, as he'd promised, following the avalanche expert's advice. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
A town in Belgium is dismantling nearly 100 streetlights along a nearby national park. In northern England, a new Dark Sky Alliance is trying to stop the spread of light pollution along a major highway. And in Copenhagen and other cities, urban lighting is being switched from white to a more animal-friendly red. These projects are all part of a growing trend trying to curb light pollution and protect biodiversity. Jana Jakushna is a lawyer and scientific coordinator working on dark skies projects. She told me at the moment there is no universal definition for what qualifies as light pollution.
For me, the best definition is that light pollution is an environmental concern which is caused by increased, unwanted, or misdirected artificial light at night and other anthropogenic lighting sources.
So excess light at night. So help us understand why it's a problem for biodiversity.
Well, it's actually a problem way broader than biodiversity, but indeed biodiversity ecosystems and habitats are suffering the most significantly from the wild spread of artificial light at night. Research shows that over 70% of species are actually nocturnal.
Wow, 70%, that stuns me.
Yes, and we talk about the environmental protection and conservation all the time, but most of these measures till recently were ignoring the nighttime environment. I will give you some examples, like turtles, the sea turtles. During the hatch season, they come onto the shore to lay their eggs, and then they urinate themselves back by the moonlight and the starlight to see where they have to go back. While the adult turtles, they don't have the problem with finding their way. The small young turtles, they do, because they're being disturbed by too many lights on the shore, on the beaches, and the car light. This is why they all go, for example, towards the roads, and we are losing a lot of species.
Something you said a moment ago really struck me. It is part of the problem, indeed, because these are nocturnal species, and we just have not seen them.
Yes. People tend to be a bit ignorant to the presence of the night, unfortunately, because we tend to think very human-centric. And when we're ignoring basically half of the, like, you know, there is a 24 cycle, which includes day and night, right? And the night consists of around 50%. By not having these measures of 50%, we're ignoring 50% of nature. But because we as humans are not active at night, only if you're working a little bit, but you have lights on. But we have lights on everywhere because that's how we feel more comfortable, I think.
So I mentioned earlier several projects that are working to curb light pollution. Where else, Jana, are we seeing the trend growing to deal with light pollution beyond Europe?
I mean, it's basically everywhere. You can see that light pollution regulations are being adopted in the United States, especially at municipal level, and also in Asian Pacific region, Australia and New Zealand. Also, you can find Latin American countries which introducing light pollution laws and regulations and lighting standards. For example, you have these norms in Peru and Chile.
So, Jana, you're in Ghent in Belgium, and with this particular project in Belgium that I mentioned earlier, there's been some community criticism about the loss of the streetlights, people saying that they're needed for safety, which tends to be a common concern for projects like this. What is your response to that?
Well, my main response is we're not trying to turn off all the lights. Mm-hmm. Like, just a ridiculous and rather difficult idea. However, nowadays, researchers are showing that you cannot basically say that more lights equal safety, because there's a lot of studies which shows when the light was introduced, the area became more illuminated, more crimes started to appear there, because more people are attracted in those areas. Therefore, criminals are also attracted there. There are also opposite trends, so we cannot say yes or no. It's more about responsible use of lights. So we rather have to reduce the illumination. We have to direct the illumination downwards so the light doesn't illuminate everything. And we shouldn't use the lights when they're simply unnecessary. When, for example, it's a national park at night, you don't need the lights there.
Finally, Jana, I mean, this focus on light pollution, we've been talking about the impact on animal species. But what about the impact on we humans? Like, if we had too much light or not enough light, what would be the impact?
I mean, we're constantly exposed to light, right? We're constantly using our PCs, our TVs, or our phone 24/7, but so we're adding extra with outdoor artificial light at night. And there are a lot of studies showing that it's very harmful for our health, both physical and mental health. And basically, it's explained by the fact that humans, like any other species, even though we tend not to think that we're a species, are relying on this circadian rhythms, the change of day and night. And when it is disturbed, our body is also reacting on that, even we think it will not react on that. So I think the main solution is just to literally use light more purposefully, because we cannot say that we will not use it at all.
Jana Jakuschna is a PhD candidate and lawyer at Ghent University in Belgium. She's also a scientific coordinator for an EU-wide light pollution project. Tamara Flores is an up-and-coming artist with roots in Austria and Mexico. She's a singer, a dancer, and also plays the flute, but it's how she taps into her cultural heritage and stitches in feminist references to her music that sets Flores apart. DW producer Laura Kabelka from the Inside Europe podcast caught up with Tamara Flores in Vienna.
You're listening to the song Chingona by the Austro-Mexican artist Tamara Flores. The music video made waves, even drawing comparisons with the world-famous Rosalía.
We planned to film a music video in Mexico, but it was just my boyfriend and I. And it was just planned that the two of us were going to film it. But apparently, we ended up being around 80, 90 person on set.
They filmed Chingona in her mother's native Acatlan, about a five-hour drive from Mexico City. And as it turns out, it really does take a village.
The whole town was supporting us. They were like, yeah, of course, what do you need? We can make you some botas, some boots. You can have my donkey, my cow, my horse. Do you want my car as well? The priest let us film on top of the church.
The colorful town and its culture are present everywhere in the clip, from the so-called Pilatos dancers with their distinct masks and costumes, right down to the cowboy boots that are produced there. Tamara also learned a lot about her roots.
For example, my grandfather was indigenous. He spoke an indigenous language, Totonaco, but he didn't pass it to his children. And when we were knocking on every door, there was one woman called Guadalupe, and she's the only one in Acatlan still speaking Totonaco. I was so impressed by her because she's 98 years old and she still remembered words of Totonaco.
Cuando amanecía, decían, sangre que tunquit.
Sangre que
tunquit. Sangre que tunquit.
She was so kind. And then I also asked her if she wanted to be part of the video, and she was like, yeah, of course. How I feel the difference with Mexico and Austria. I feel like maybe we are just here a little bit more reserved. Of course, it's not everyone.
Tamara also showcases Vienna's beauty in her work. She also sings in German. Her latest video was filmed in multiple locations around Vienna, including in front of St. Stephen's Cathedral and an iconic café. Here's a little sneak peek at her not yet published song, Infinito.
Simplemente que no dejan de gritar, pensamientos como fuego no lo puedo apagar. Mil preguntas que no sé si me van a contestar y un deseo de volar sin tener que explicar.
And while Vienna consistently ranks among the world's most livable cities, it was also listed as the unfriendliest city for expats a few years ago. Surveyed expats said locals were specifically unfriendly towards foreigners. Tamara's belonging was also often questioned here.
For a long time, I felt between two cultures because I was born here, I'm Austrian, but a lot of people would always ask me, ah, but where are you really from? I can see that you're not from Austria. I got this from a really young age, and maybe that's also why I didn't felt I'm really Austrian. I'm too Mexican to be Austrian, but also, of course, in Mexico, it's also, I feel like that I'm too Austrian for really being in Mexico because I didn't live in Mexico for long.
Online, a lot of people could connect to her experience and reached out to her.
Because a lot of people grew up maybe with immigrant parents or in between two cultures, basically. You kind of want to categorize yourself where you are exactly from. But the last years I found out maybe that's not the freaking point. Like, I am who I am.
And who that is, she expresses through recurring themes and colors. Red is all over her videos. In Chingona, which means strong, badass woman, she and her group of dancers all have a red horizontal line on their faces.
Red was always my favorite color, but red is also a symbol for strength, for anger, for love, for blood, and this coexists a lot in womanhood, that I wanted to feel like a warrior.
In Tamara's art, feminism seems to be the red thread. And so is her signature 10-meter-long braid. In one scene, she uses this braid like a lasso and wraps a local cowboy in it.
Okay, this shot must maybe a little hint against patriarchy. This system where it's just built for men. At the end of the day, women are also allies. And these allies would be especially men. And that's why also the man I'm wrapping my braid around, at the end, he's the last person in the shot. And I'm dancing with him as well, because we need to have also the support of men.
Overall, Tamara says, the braid symbolizes the connection to other women as well as to her own roots, whether they be in Austria or Mexico.
Laura, Kabelka's story comes to us from Inside Europe, produced by our partners at Deutsche Welle. Find more of their work wherever you get podcasts. You're with the world. President Trump announced late last year that the U.S. would import more beef from Argentina. That is not going over well with American cattle ranchers. But one study says the overall impact on the U.S. market is likely to be minimal. More than anything, this appears to be a gift for Argentina's President Javier Milei to help shore up support at home. The beef industry there has been struggling. But as Emily Johnson reports from Buenos Aires, that may be about to change.
It's early in the morning at the Mercado Agroganadero, an enormous cattle market about an hour outside Buenos Aires, and the buyers are lining up. The bells start ringing at 7:30, says head of institutional relations Valeria Tarejo. When buyers see there are enough people, the bidding starts, and they move from one auction to the next. Cowhands known as gauchos in distinctive neckerchiefs and beret-like hats ride horses up and down the lanes, moving the animals from pen to pen in the marketplace. There are Angus cattle with beautiful black and red hides, largely bound for domestic markets, and an abundance of bony black and white cattle, mostly destined for China. Only a small percentage of exports go to the United States.
The White House has been trying to thread a needle.
That's Vince Smith, a professor of economics at Montana State University and director of the Agricultural Policy Program at the American Enterprise Institute.
And the needle is the president wanted to help the current administration in Argentina.
President Trump said allowing in more Argentinian beef would reduce meat prices in the U.S. and increase demand. Smith calls that, quote, a nothing burger.
Argentina is a very small player in the U.S. market for beef with a very small share of total exports.
The increased imports from Argentina were announced in October, around the same time the White House authorized a $20 billion bailout to boost Argentina's flailing economy, only days before the legislative election where Milei's party emerged with a decisive victory.
The fiscal bailout for Argentina of $20 billion is far more important in terms of its impact on Argentina, than expanding the under-quoted tariff amount allowed to be shipped to the U.S. in terms of beef. But they're linked.
Americans have long had a romantic image of Argentinian beef. Here in the land of asado, it's hard to overstate its cultural importance. Except for maybe soccer, there's no faster way to the hearts of Argentinians than through access to affordable, high-quality steak. But prices have fluctuated wildly since Milei took office, which has forced many families to be strategic. According to Cristian Domenicelli, who works at a butcher shop in the Buenos Aires neighborhood of Devoto, more people are buying cheaper cuts and taking advantage of promos.
Carne van a comprar siempre y siempre van a comer carne. O sea, otra no queda. O sea, es algo de.
They will always buy meat and they will always eat meat, he says. It is something that will always be the case. 100 years ago, Argentina was the largest beef exporter in the world, accounting for more than half of total global exports. In recent decades, the industry has been hamstrung by tight limits on exports aimed at curbing inflation and prioritizing the domestic supply. But that has changed under Milei, and savvy young entrepreneurs are starting to branch out from tradition with more boutique beef.
Cattle farming in Argentina is very conservative. Nobody believed that there was something different to that classic Angus Argentinian beef.
Juaní Barcos is a chef, restaurant owner, and cattle farmer. In the 90s, his father, a veterinarian, worked for the Argentinian equivalent of the USDA and was sent on a trip to Japan.
And this is the time when my father saw and tried for the first time Wagyu beef.
Wagyu refers to several Japanese breeds that produce highly marbled, very expensive cuts of beef. His father introduced Wagyu genetics to Argentina for the first time in 1998.
He was the first in Latin America to introduce that new breed. And then a few years ago, I started working with him in the project.
Here at Madre Rojas, Barcos restaurant in the up-and-coming neighborhood of Villa Crespo, steaks hiss on an enormous grill. The menu lists the provenance of every cut of meat, something he sees as hugely important.
It's not just enough to say that we sell Argentine beef. The market are requesting more information, traceability, and reliability. Nobody trusts that picture about Angus cattle eating grass on the pampas anymore. This is not the way the majority of the Argentine beef is produced.
That is to say, contrary to the much publicized image of happy cows in Argentina's iconic grasslands, the majority of beef produced here now is grain-fed, or at least grain-finished. But Barcos says there are new young players in the industry emerging every year, and that old-school methods that had fallen out of wide-scale practice, like grass-fed production, are now in vogue.
I think that the scene is now changing. The challenge for the next years in Argentina is, in my opinion, is to show that we can produce added value beef, not just for local consumption, but also for the exportation markets.
Fernando Bianchi is showing me the pasture at La Julia Organics, where some of his 1,000 head of cattle are clustered around a patch of trees for shade. One particularly friendly cow comes over to say hello.
Esa es Dulce.
This is Dulce, he says. True to her name, she's a sweetie, nudging me to pet her before trying to nibble on my microphone.
Oh! Hey, easy.
La Julia began operating in 1994 and continues to be run as a family farm. Bianchi has seen the industry go through much political and economic upheaval in that time. Meat was always a reason for political disputes, he says. Since meat was always considered a primary consumer good in the Argentinian diet, they tried in every possible way to limit price increases, no matter how much that meant closing exports and complicating life for the producer, the exporter, and everyone else. Looking ahead, with modern consumers being so discerning about quality, he sees more opportunity for small producers like La Julia to reassert the grass-fed practices that are Argentina's heritage. So this isn't just potentially a transformative time for the cattle industry on the world stage, but here at home as well. For The World, I'm Emily Johnson, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Before we leave you today, let's talk about spring. That's when a newly discovered sun-grazing comet may come into view, a comet that gets so close to the sun that it explodes in a dazzling display. Amateur astronomers actually spotted the comet last month. It's near Mars right now, and if it stays on course, the fireworks will happen in April. Sun grazers do sometimes disintegrate before they reach the sun, so file under something we're watching. Tomorrow on the show, we'll bring you the latest news on elections in Bangladesh, where the previous prime minister was ousted in a popular uprising. My co-host Carolyn Beeler is in Dhaka as people choose their next government. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Piggott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.